Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the KRFY Morning Show. This is the morning, your morning show host, Julie Calamine. And this morning, we are so lucky to be joined by one of our favorite folks that joins us from time to time. It's TJ Ross. TJ, you are the communications manager here for Idaho Fish and Game. I think you're what, in the panhandle or panhandle division, something like that?
Yep. So I'm in the panhandle region based out of our Coeur d'Alene office. Our regional communications manager, I've been with the department actually for 13 years, which just shocks me how quickly it flies by when you're having fun. But I've been in this position now for 4 years. And prior to that, I was a fishery research biologist on the Kootenai River working to get the burbot fishery open. So I've done quite a few different things and absolutely loving my role with Fish and Game now.
Isn't that wonderful? And you didn't, I'm trying to remember your history. Did you start out in Idaho? Are you from Idaho originally, or did you move from somewhere like Minnesota?
I moved from somewhere else, not Minnesota, from Oklahoma, actually. So I was born and raised in Oklahoma and then went to graduate school for 3 years in upstate New York. And then left New York, had a short stint in Michigan, and then continued west and landed in Idaho and haven't looked back since. Absolutely love it here.
So true. And you seem to be well-suited to communications. You've been in this role for a couple of years, what, three or four, as you mentioned, a few years. And it has flown by, hasn't it?
It has flown by. And again, like I said earlier, time flies when you're having fun. And that's how I think of working for the department, particularly this job. It's just fun. I love being able to tell our story and tell people why we do what we do and how it impacts them and why it's important work for them. Most people who live in Idaho love the fish and wildlife and scenic views that Idaho offers, and we're here to conserve all of that. And so it's fun being able to talk about the things that I know that people care about.
Yes, and you do get out of the office from time to time, I know, because I'll come looking for you and you're off on location doing something.
I do, yes. And so unlike what I used to do as a fish biologist, when I go out in the field now, I've got my camera gear in tow, my drone, anything that I need to take good photos and videos of the work that our staff are doing, put together stories, put together videos to showcase all of that. So it's definitely different than what I used to do, but I do get out in the field quite a bit, which is nice to scratch that itch.
That's for sure. I like that you can do that. Well, you've got quite a laundry list of items for us to talk about this morning, so I guess we better launch on in. First one is spearfishing on Lake Pendre. Wow, how did that come into being and become legal, etc.?
Yeah, so it's fairly new and pretty exciting. We didn't really know what to expect from it, but that is a new opportunity that came to be July 1st, 2025. So we're only a little over a month in to spearfishing being legal. And so that was initiated at the May 2024 commission meeting that was held here in Coeur d'Alene. Essentially what happened is we had the commission there and our staff, and during the public testimony portion, there were some spear fishermen from the Sandpoint area, particularly Lake Pendre, that showed up and said, hey, we love to spearfish. There's no opportunity to spearfish for game fish. And we're looking at Lake Pendre, where you guys are talking about us and you guys are paying anglers to harvest walleye and lake trout. You don't want northern pike in there. We want to help with that effort, and we want to do it via spearfishing. And so they really approached us in a very thoughtful and intentional way. And the commission heard what they had to say and began pursuing that coming to be. And so that rule went into effect on July 1st, 2025. So that's how it came to be. And so we're a month in and kind of tracking how things are going and keep in touch with some of the spear fishermen and hearing some promising and encouraging results on their end.
Well, give me an example. What sorts of things are you hearing?
Yeah, so they are, so far, have been pretty darn successful at spearing walleye. There have been some pike that have been speared. And for folks that aren't familiar, we have an angler incentive program for walleye. And so at any given time, there's roughly 100 walleye swimming around in Lake Pendre that have little microscopic metal tags in the tip of their nose. And if a person catches or spears one of those walleye and turns the head into us, that fish is worth $1,000. And so in the last month, we have had two of those fish turned in by spear fishermen.
Wow. How many are still out there, do you know?
Well, that's kind of a rough number because we don't know how many have survived from year to year, but we aim to have roughly 100 of them out there at any given time. So there's roughly $100,000 worth of walleye swimming around in Lake Ponderay.
It's a big darn lake, though. So
yeah.
The chances are low, but the rewards would be fun if it worked out. What does it look like, a person spearfishing? I am from Minnesota, and the only time that we had spearfishing, well, okay, there were two ways. There were a couple of ways that it could be done. One would be sort of either from docks or shore, and folks would sometimes spearfish for carp in the spring. That was legal. But the only legal game fish spearfishing we had was during ice fishing season. So is it from boats, from shore? How do they do that? It's a deep lake.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a little bit of both, but most of it's occurring in shallower water. So, you know, a lot of effort going into the bays or anywhere that they can get into the shallower water where presumably the walleye and the northern pike would be. So that's where most of it's occurring. Most of it's free diving. So not scuba gear, but free diving and approaching it that way.
So they're actually swimming around with like a spear gun.
Yep, with a spear gun. They're in the water. They're down there in the thick of it, face to face with these fish and pursuing them that way.
Wow, that does sound exciting. I can see why they were excited and interested in being able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sounds like a win-win if the fish were wanting those fish out of the lake and it makes another recreational activity for folks up in the area.
We couldn't agree more.
Yeah, how interesting. Okay, well, that is interesting, and we'll continue to hear how that's going and what the harvests are like. But that then means that I guess folks need to be looking out for people that are fishing and in the water. Do they put up a I'm scuba diving kind of, bobber or something?
They do. So most of them are using the standard diving flags and diving markers.
Sure.
And I think it will take some time for boaters to get used to looking for that. And, you know, anybody that's new to spearfishing to understand that they need to do that as well for their own safety. So there's probably going to be a little bit of a time lag there, but they are taking the necessary precautions.
Oh, good. All right. Well, listeners, watch out for the spear fishermen then. They're out there in the water. Good to know. Well, okay, next topic, and this one sounds very interesting. We always love to hear the enforcement stories from the panhandle. And in your notes, I see why the recent surge. So fill us in, TJ.
Yeah, so anybody that's been paying attention to the press lately, or at least over the past couple of weeks, has probably noticed a little bit of an uptick in information that we're putting out about different cases that are either currently ongoing or completed relative to what our conservation officers do. And so just wanted to acknowledge that, there is an uptick. And it's not that there's an uptick in them solving cases like this. It's really just an uptick in us reporting on these cases. And we really want to do that because, you know, our conservation officers, they are in the thick of it day in and day out. They are law enforcement. They're no different than, sheriff's deputy or police department deputy or police department officer. So they have all the same rights that those officers do, and they're working hard to make sure that people are not taking advantage of the fish and wildlife resources of Idaho. And we want to showcase that. One, because it's really incredible work that they're doing. It's a lot of investigative type detective work. You know, DNA analyses, looking at bullet casings and rifling and all these different things that they do that is really incredible. And so we want people to know what they're doing and why they're doing it, and also to discourage any type of illegal poaching activity that somebody might be considering, knowing that our officers are really good at what they do, and they're constantly on the prowl trying to keep people from pursuing those illegal activities.
Yes, and by reporting it does point out that people that you're enforcement folks are out and working on jobs. What is sort of typical in the reporting? I see you've listed like hook and bullet and shooting the bull. Are those places where this is reported?
No, so that's different. So these okay. are, I mean, we talk about them on our podcast, but these, we've been putting these out as essentially newspaper stories.
Oh, fine.
So press releases, and then newspapers are picking them up, and we, you know, put them on Facebook and try to get this information circulated. And it's been very well received. And
oh,
I
good.
Think people appreciate knowing what our officers are up to and the work that they're doing. And it's really important work when we're talking about trophy animals that are being illegally harvested. That's taking opportunities away from those of us who are hunters and who are not pursuing illegal ways of poaching. And so people appreciate hearing that. And our officers are doing it all the time. And we're just making a concerted effort to talk about it more so people know what's going on.
Right. Well, it really hurts, as you just said, it hurts everybody when people don't play by the rules, because the rules are made so that the game, so that our fish and game populations can be healthy and, you know, and kept at a certain level. And if people aren't following the rules, then of course that can't be guaranteed as easily. So what would be a typical report this time of the year? What sort of things are the fish and game enforcement officers finding?
Yeah, so this time of year, there's honestly not a lot going on besides fishing. They're doing a lot of fishing patrols. However, what they are working on usually this time of year is, you know, tracking these different cases, like wildlife cases, hunting-related cases, that are working their way through the court system. So, you know, they're, you know, pulling together all of the evidence, going to, you know, different trials and different court processes to provide that evidence. And so they've always got different cases that are in different stages of the court process. And so that they put a lot of time and effort and energy into that. And, you know, one thing that is very interesting to me is that I don't know the percentage, but a large number of the cases that our officers get involved with, they get involved with because of they receive a call through the Citizens Against Poaching line from someone in the public, from a hunter or a concerned landowner that maybe heard a gunshot at night or something like that. And I cannot emphasize how important those cap calls are, and that anytime someone calls something like that in, our officers always look into it because they are typically very productive.
Oh, good. That's good to hear. And they can be anonymous or not? Are they?
Yeah, they can be.
Okay. Very good. Yeah, because if you're turning in someone who you might know or something, one might want to remain anonymous.
For sure. Yep.
Yeah, but it's the right thing to do, listeners. So don't hold back. People shouldn't be breaking the game laws. Okay.
I agree.
Well, good. Well, good deal. Glad to hear that everybody is on top of that and working on cases, and then going on to podcasts. And that then brings us to, for example, Hook and Bulletin and Shooting the Bull. Tell us about the podcasts.
Yeah, so I love podcasts, so maybe I'm a little bit biased, but we have some really creative folks in our headquarters office that about a year and a half, 2 years ago, got interested in starting a fishing game podcast. So they started what's called the Hook and Bulletin. That's been going for over a year now, year and a half, and it's basically a recap of any news articles that the department across the state put out for the week. So it's like a weekly news roundup, but it's done with a little bit of creativity, and it's essentially listening to the news rather than sitting down and reading it. And so some people like myself prefer that, and that has been gaining in popularity. And so that's going on. And what we started doing was kind of intermittently injecting some more of the conversational type podcasts into the Hook and Bulletin, where, you know, the host would sit down and interview staff, interview conservation officers, whatever, and do some storytelling or talk about a project that was going on. And what we found is that those episodes were particularly popular with the public. And so that led to, a couple of weeks ago, the launching of a separate podcast channel called Shooting the Bull. And that's going to be 1 to 2 episodes a month. And it really is like a storytelling episode where, like I said, the host is sitting down with staff, learning about what they do, where they came from, what they're interested in, and just kind of talking with them to hear their perspective. So I actually had the privilege of last week or the week before sitting down with the two hosts and then two of our conservation officers, and walking them through some storytelling of what a day in their life looks like. And it was a lot of fun. And I was super interested in the conversation in person. And so I think when that podcast goes live, people will really enjoy that, kind of hearing those perspectives.
That really does sound fun. And podcasts are fun, of course, because you can, you know, be doing your laundry or whatever while you listen. So they're great multitasking educational opportunities. I love a good podcast.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. Driving to work or taking a road trip, whatever, podcast is a great way to pass the time by and learn something along the way, like you said.
Oh, I know it. Okay, listeners, so keep an eye open and go ahead to the Idaho Fish and Game website and look for the podcast Hook and Bulletin and Shooting the Bull. I will be.
Awesome.
Yeah, sounds fun. All right, well, TJ... Oh, and then I hope... Okay, I've got to back up for just a moment. In the Shooting the Bull category, I began this story with you, TJ, before we went to begin recording, and I met a new Fish and Game officer who's new and works up at Cabinet Gorge, so maybe there'll be an opportunity where we'll hear him at some point, what they're doing up there. He was hiking Scotchman Peak, so he's a guy who gets out and does stuff and then also gets his work done with Fish and Game. So that's always fun to run into you guys out in other activities, too. Now, I wanted to have us move on, and this topic is rather near and dear to my heart for a couple of reasons. The elk hunting season, the cow season is changed this year, and that's been a season that I've been able to take advantage of in the past, and so it sounds like that maybe won't be the case, and so you'll tell us about that. And then, of course, chronic wasting, we'll want an update on that.
Yep. Yeah, so things do look a little bit different for the cow elk hunting opportunity this year, and that was based on public feedback that we have received over the past several years and then that we formally received during our public comment period for big game season setting. And so initially our proposal was to remove all cow harvest opportunity on either the A and or both the A and the B tag. What we heard from the public when we proposed that was, look, we agree that there needs to be less cow harvest. However, we would like some opportunity to remain. And so we went back to the drawing board, and what we put forward to the commission was essentially no cow harvest on the B tag, which is the essentially the rifle tag. And on the A tag, which is the archery tag, cow harvest is still going to remain for about a week. And then for both the A and the B tag, the muzzle loader season will be retained for cow harvest. So the big change is for anybody hunting with the B tag. We used to have, I think it was 3 days where you could harvest a cow on or within a mile of private land.
Right.
That portion of the season is no longer in place.
Okay. And then for those who might use a muzzle loader, does that come later, or is that generally later in the season, or is that consecutive running along with the rifle season?
That's later in the season.
Okay. So for those who still want to use some form of a firearm, there could still be a cow opportunity, but it would come later.
Yep. Yeah, it would come later. Right. So that's a pretty big change. I don't remember how long ago it was that we brought the cow hunting opportunity back. I think it was 6 or 7 years ago, maybe a little longer. And we were excited about that. Folks were excited about it too. But the harvest expectations that we had were exceeded, and so we knew it was time to dial something back, and this is where we landed. And I know, as with anything, we know that some folks are thrilled with it. We've heard that they want all cow hunting to stop. Other folks are really frustrated, and I get that, because cows are a great way to fill your freezer. And so we're trying to walk that knife edge and find the middle ground that we can keep some opportunity on the table, but also cut back some of the harvest to give the population, give the herd time to kind of rebound.
Sure. And do you find that the elk herd has been successful and to varying degrees based on the part of the state we're in, or is it sort of an overall issue this whole cow season?
No. So, and we're doing, yeah, I would say overall doing well. We've got plenty of elk in the panhandle, and it varies widely from unit to unit. And a lot of the, I'd say, like a lot of the front country elk populations that are near ag, as you might imagine, are doing particularly well. And then you get further into the back country and not doing as well there. And so we're just trying to balance all of that to make it jive.
Sure. Maybe some of those fat cows that live near the ag areas will move back into the woods and take over some of that.
I don't know. They've got a dinner plate right there in front of them. It's hard to turn down.
Right. It is tough. That's for sure. Well, all right. So that is a big change. Everybody needs to be aware of that, those who are interested in elk hunting and particularly the cows for that short season. So I'm glad that we're able to talk about that. Now, on to chronic wasting. We brought in an elk head last fall, and it came back negative of chronic wasting. But give us an update. What do we know?
Yep. So what we know, there's not a lot that has changed from when we first detected it throughout the So that was, we detected it in July of 2024. So a lot happened to get ready for that once we, to prepare and figure out how we were going to move forward once we got that detection. And since that time, there's been a total of 6 deer, including that one, that have tested positive for chronic wasting disease, all in Unit 1, all in the Bonner's Ferry area. Which is actually pretty good. I can't recall we call it the prevalence rate of chronic wasting disease in deer in Unit 1, but it's like less than 1%, which is very good and basically tells us that we caught the disease early, which early detection is really important for chronic wasting disease. So it's still there, obviously, but we've still got a long road ahead of us.
Sure.
Once it's there, it's going to remain there.
I was going to ask, I mean, I doubt that you can eradicate it, but how does knowing that it exists help with controlling it?
We can hone in on, more specifically where the core of it is, where it started and how it spread from there. So that's important.
And maybe do controlled hunts or something. You can try and reduce that population or something like that where you don't.
Exactly. And so we've actually restructured some of the, so Unit 1 traditionally has always had around 900 extra doe tags. Still has that plus about 100 more, I believe, but we've restructured it to be a little bit more centered within that chronic wasting disease management zone, with the goal of trying to keep numbers at bay in that localized area, which is an important part of chronic wasting disease. If we've learned anything from what other states have done and have not done, it's that if you take the hands-off approach, what you end up with 15, 20 years down the road is a lot of sick deer that are going to start dying off, and you start to see these heavy population level effects. And the prevalence in places like Wyoming, for example, can be upwards of 50 to 60%. So shoot a deer, you got a 50 to 60% chance it's CWD positive.
That's pretty high. That's really not cool. Let me ask you, I know at least for me last fall, testing was not mandatory. Will there be any attempt to really increase the testing in that area where we know is sort of the center of chronic wasting?
Yep. So in the entire chronic wasting disease management zone, which is basically all of Unit 1 east of the Selkirk Divide, it is mandatory.
Okay.
So we'll have head barrels all over the place. We'll have head freezers all over the place. We'll likely be running a CWD sampling station at the search and rescue boat launch there in Bonner's Ferry again this year. People can bring heads to the regional office. So we're trying to make it as easy as possible for folks to be compliant with that mandatory requirement. But it is mandatory in the chronic wasting disease management zone.
That's excellent. I think that gives us our best possible chance of keeping it, at least keeping chronic wasting controlled here in the state of Idaho. So good work, you guys.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, hopefully that'll really make a difference and keep it under control for as long as we can hope into the future. All right, so that's about what we know with chronic wasting. Oh, you've got a bear update, Bear Fair in Bonner County. Tell us more.
Yeah, so this is a pretty fun event. I believe this is the third year that we've done it. The first 2 years it was at the Boundary County Fairgrounds. So this year it's at Bonner County. I'm hoping that we can reach more of the Sandpoint, Coeur d'Alene, Bonners, like bring them all together at more of a centralized location. But really the whole impetus with this Bear Fair is to get people there and to raise awareness about what it means to safely live and recreate in bear country. So we live in North Idaho. We say this all the time. North Idaho is bear country. We've got grizzly bears. We've got black bears. And there are certain things that you do and don't want to do when it comes to bears. And so this is an opportunity for folks to learn that from some of the experts, from some of our biologists, from staff with the Kootenai Tribe of Idaho. We'll have other vendors there that have bear-proof things and bear-aware materials. So really trying to just create an event where people can kind of one-stop learn it all. Usually the highlight of the event, two highlights I guess I'll share. One is we will have our remote-controlled grizzly bear there, which is, if folks have never done it, it's very eye-opening. The whole idea is you have this remote-controlled grizzly bear that charges at you. You got bear spray on your hip, and it's an opportunity to turn around and practice spraying a charging grizzly bear. And it's, I say it's eye-opening because you realize how quickly the grizzly bear covers ground and how hard it is to get your bear spray off your hip, unlocked, and ready to fire before the bear's there. So
yes.
We got that as a highlight. And then the second one is we bring a cider press every year. And so we encourage folks to pick up their apples, pick them out of the trees, pick them up off the ground, bring them to the cider press, turn them into cider. And the reason for that is keeping the apples off the ground keeps bears away. Those are big attractants for bears. And so this is a great way to put those apples to good use.
Yeah, keeping the apples out of your yard and out of places that you don't want bears to show up. Of course, it makes sense.
Yep.
There's plenty of apples out and about that I think they can run into. Now, I've noticed that you have a new grizzly bear biologist, and that person is based out of Sandpoint. So let's hear about that person, and where in Sandpoint are they based, he or she?
Yeah. So her name is Morgan Fander. She used to be based out of the Coeur d'Alene office, and then she transferred over into this grizzly bear position, which has a heavy focus on, you know, information, education, outreach relative to grizzly bears and black bears, and she's very good at it. So she's really enjoying that, and she's living in a fishing game bunkhouse property in Sandpoint. I'm not sure exactly where it is in Sandpoint, but the idea is that she's based out of Sandpoint so that she can serve the Sandpoint area, the Boundary County area, and be the boots on the ground when it comes to grizzly bear or black bear conflict. So if folks have livestock that grizzly bears or black bears are getting into, or if there's an issue on a trail or whatever, that she can be there poised and ready to go. And so she's doing that. She's the one coordinating and organizing the bear fair with the Kootenai Tribe of Idaho. She also has one staff person who's actually a retired fish and game conservation officer. His name's Rob Morris. And he helps with all of these things, and he actually is also in charge of running a livestock carcass pickup program. So we have a big dump trailer that if folks have a cow or a horse or whatever that dies on their property and they don't know what to do with it, this is a free service. We'll come and pick up the carcass and remove it, again, to prevent that attractant for grizzly bears.
Well, that is quite a service. Wow, that's more than one might expect the bear folks to be doing up here in the county. So really proactive and good to hear about it. Now, is anyone from Fish and Game responsible for that? I think we have a pull-behind trailer that offers bear education. Is that something the folks up here use?
It is. That's all. Morgan and Rob use that constantly. I think last time I heard from Morgan, she had 37 events planned for July and August. So she and Rob are all over the place trying to get the word out. And again, the rationale with this is that if we can, not always, but a lot of times, grizzly bear or black bear issues originate with human behavior. And in result, usually the bear is the one that loses out in that scenario. And so
right.
We're trying to just, drive the two by making sure that humans understand what our role is and how we can prevent creating issues with bears, which keeps the bears wild, keeps them out of our spaces, and everybody ends up happier. So they're working super hard to get to that point.
Yeah, good for those guys. And another one that I always think of is our bird feeders, because they can be quite an attractant for bears too.
Absolutely.
So maybe not best out in the summer, wait till the bears go to sleep.
Yep, I couldn't agree more.
That's right. Well, okay, so that's going to be fun. Hopefully we'll see Morgan or Rob out and about here in the Sandpoint or more parts north and learn plenty more about what's going on with the bears and how to be the best citizens and see that we can coexist coexist, obviously. And that, though, does bring us back to the state fair, because I know, of course, Morgan's going to be doing the bear fair, but is there more happening at the state fair August 15th to the 24th, Idaho State Fair?
Yep. So we're here in Coeur d'Alene at the North Idaho State Fairgrounds. We will be there. We've got a building that used to be a kind of just a fish and game wildlife building with, you know, taxidermy and some activities. Kind of got outdated, and so a couple years ago, not kind of, it was very outdated. And so a couple years ago, we made the decision to revamp that, kept a lot of the taxidermy, reorganized it, but the big push was to convert that entire space into a 3D youth archery range. And so we've been running, this will be our third year running that.
Oh.
It has been a huge hit. A lot of fun to put on.
I can just imagine. That sounds great. Tell us what exactly goes on. What are those kids shooting at?
Yep. So we've got about 15, 20 targets up. We've got a wolf, a bear, a turkey, a badger, deer. I think the highlight is a 5 foot tall velociraptor.
Oh.
People love shooting at that thing.
That sounds fun. And
Last year, the past 2 years, over the course of it's roughly a 10-day fair, we've had about 2,500 kids that have come through, and they're each shooting, you know, 10 to 15 shots. So there are a lot of arrows that are being flung, and we get really cool feedback from the parents. There's been many parents that have come through and seen how much their kids have enjoyed it. They take a picture of the make and model of the bow, and they've actually followed up with us after, and these kids are shooting at targets in their backyard now, which is the goal, to get people exposed to archery as a sport, whether they hunt or not. It's getting them into the sport, and it's a good way for us to connect with the community while doing that.
Yeah, two questions. Are there some girls that get involved, and about what age range would you say is most enjoying that activity?
Yep, plenty of girls, and I'll be honest, I think not always, but a lot of times the girls have a much steadier shot, so they're doing extremely well. And I'd say that the ideal age is probably in the 10 to 16 range. We help kids that are younger than that shoot, but sometimes they struggle being able to pull the bow back. But
sure,
we're always happy to help. I mean, our staff really enjoy working the fair and getting to interact with so many kids and their parents. And it's a fun event for all of us.
That does sound fun. That sounds like it would be worth popping in and observing, even if you didn't have a little one to.
Yep.
Teach how to shoot a bow and arrow. Fun. Well, that leads us into another place where there's shooting happening, and that is the Farragut Shooting Range, which is not too far from us here in Sandpoint, down at Farragut.
Yeah, so I'm always putting a plug in for Farragut Shooting Range. Obviously, again, I'm biased. I work for the department. I help manage the shooting range, but man, that place is such a special place. For shooting clay pigeons, shooting pistol, shooting rifle. Got an amazing 3D archery range that's like a mile-long trail through the woods with these different stations set up for different 3D archery targets.
And now, and TJ, I've got to back up just a second because I see that you specifically noted the youth archery range. And is that just at Farragut, or is that also, well, that's sort of the 3D, is that happening at the fair or just out of Farragut?
The 3D youth archery range is at the fairground.
Okay.
We have a separate 3D archery range in the woods out at Farragut.
So okay, got it.
Technically two different 3D archery ranges.
Okay, I noticed that I missed the one. So when folks are at the state fair, they can definitely, well, the youth can come and check out the 3D, but if we adults want to have some 3D fun, it's at Farragut. Okay,
yep.
You go on then.
That's right. And the thing that I think is amazing about Farragut is you can do all of that we talked about. If you're an adult, it's $10 a day. If you're a kid, it's $5 a day. And
wow,
that includes all those things that we just talked about. I mean, you can barely go eat at McDonald's now. I don't think you can eat at McDonald's for less than $10.
No, so you can throw clay targets. There's a pistol range, rifle range, the 3D archery, and even more, and that's 10 bucks a day. That is a bargain.
I agree. I think it's a smoking deal. Come kids with, you know, come bring your kids, family oriented, and your kids are paying five bucks a day to get in. We're not running the range to make money. We're running the range to provide an opportunity. So we have to make money to break even and to pay for operational expenses, and that's all we're out to do. So
yeah. Teach some ethics, some education, some good ethics, and let folks understand how to have fun in a safe and, you know, fair way that we're looking for. That's cool. You know, we started talking about fishing, and I note that we have more to talk about in relationship to fishing, and that is about the heat of the summer and how the fish are handling that and what are the implications for us as fishing people. So let's jump into that one.
Yeah, this is one that is near and dear to me, and I think it's really important. So a lot of surrounding states, when it gets to the heat of summer like this, they implement either fishing closures, mostly for trout, or the hoot owl hours where you can't fish during the middle of the day out of concerns about stressing the fish and fish not handling being caught very well. And Fish and Game has taken a very different approach to that and has done a lot of research to kind of look at this. And essentially, we're not in the business of regulating when people fish based on temperature, mostly because it's pretty self-regulating. And what I mean by that is when fish are hot and stressed out and trying to stay cool, they're really not interested in feeding anyway. So a person could go fish for them, but they're not going to be very successful in the first place. And so if somebody wants to do that, then why not let them get out and try? But that's not true for all rivers. We've talked about this before. Priest River is one that's a little bit different. A lot of the other rivers have cold water pockets. When things get really warm, fish can find cold water pockets. Priest River is a bit of an anomaly on that front. It comes off the surface of Priest Lake, so it's just a warmer river. With fewer of those cold water pockets. That's not to say that people shouldn't go out and fish it, but the trout most likely move out of Priest River and into some of the cooler tributaries when things get hot like this.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I'm going to say this was 5 years ago. The Panhandle chapter of Trout Unlimited did a little fishing, like a creel survey. We went, 15 of us fished as much of Priest River below that dam as we could manage in kayaks and little single person floating whatever's, canoes or kayaks, what have you, or little pontoons. And so interesting because one of us was also dragging a thermometer that was monitoring temperature where we were fishing throughout the day. Everybody had one for the stretch that they were going to be fishing in. And there were just a couple of little cold water refugios, that's what we were calling them then, refugios. And yes, we caught a few trout in those cool spots, but basically, you know, nothing going on in the warmer areas. They're just not even in there. And if they are in there, they wouldn't be feeding. So that does support what you're saying today.
Yep. And I think that's pretty true in other rivers too, that when it gets hot, those fish know where to go. And for the most part, they're shutting down and not eating anyway, besides early morning when it's cooled off overnight. So it's kind of a, like I said, self-regulating mechanism. And I guess where I would leave people is don't feel bad for getting out and fishing. We feel comfortable with it. We've researched it and feel very confident where we've landed. And so if you want to get out and fish and it's hot, go for it. Chances of catching fish are probably pretty slim, like if you're fishing for trout, but you never know.
Right. And one could always fish for the warmer water species, the sunnies and the crappies and the bass and all those guys might be deciding to eat. And the pike and the walleye, too, I would think, are possibly eating that.
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah. And so there's no issue with those fish anyway. Well, that's really interesting. And it's a little different way of looking at things as compared to, let's say, Montana with all the hoot owl regulations happening on a lot of the trout streams. So yeah, interesting. That's very interesting. Well, TJ, we've gone on and on. It's 40 minutes already, and I'm mostly have run through your outline that you prepared for me. Usually I'm the outline preparer, and you've done a great job of having plenty to talk about here. Is there anything else we should be thinking about as we come to an end?
You know, I just think, and I think I say this every time, but I encourage anybody that's listening to this that has questions, comments, concerns, whatever it is, call the office, swing by anytime. I work here with these people. I know them very dearly. And every single person in this office cares deeply about, one, the fish and wildlife resources in Idaho, and two, and even more importantly, the people who use those. We're literally here working for the people of Idaho. We want to hear the good, the bad, the ugly from the people of Idaho. We may not always be able to give you the thing that you want, and you may not like the answer that we have, but we will always be happy to have the conversation. So I hope people believe me when I say that and take us up on it.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to end this talk, and I have to concur. Anytime I've reached out to Fish and Game with a question or needing information, I've always gotten nothing but, you know, really friendly, informational help. So I'll stand by that statement that you're making. All right. Well, I think that's about it for us then, TJ. So TJ Ross, once again, you are communications manager for the Panhandle region up here of Idaho Fish and Game. And I just want to thank you for taking the time to fill in the listeners here at KRFY on what's going on and what we might be thinking about doing and just giving us a great update. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, Julie. It's always a pleasure.
All right. We'll try it again as winter comes along. Thanks, TJ.